Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to this fourth session of Stakeholder Forum's countdown to the UN SDG Summit 2023 series of eight webinars in the run-up to the September 2023 SDG Summit. With the support of experts from all over the world, please pardon me, my script is disappearing. With the support of experts in each of the first 16 SDGs, we have been reviewing two SDGs each month. We began in November 2022, and we will continue with this process through June of 2023 in the run-up to the July 2023 United Nations High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development. The series continues to explore where we are in SDG implementation and to identify transformative actions for change. Today's event has been organized by Stakeholder Forum for a Sustainable Future in connection with our proposed 2023 platform, an instrument to support more effective monitoring and review of the implementation of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development during the 2023 United Nations High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development review cycle. I'm Charles Newhan, Chairman of Stakeholder Forum for a Sustainable Future, and I'm your host today from New York. As you can see on your screen, we have a panel of special guests who, with a diverse range of experiences and knowledge, will be introduced by my colleague David O'Connor in the coming minutes. For those of you not familiar with Stakeholder Forum, it is an international not-for-profit NGO that, in consultative status with the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs, commonly known as ECOSOC, since 1996. SF has, for more than 25 years, been working to advance sustainable development at all levels. SF provides the bridge between those who have a stake in sustainable development and the international forums where decisions are made in their name. Now, a bit of housekeeping, just briefly before we begin. Please note that the webinar is being live streamed on YouTube, and a link to the recording will be posted on the Stakeholder Forum website soon thereafter. As you will see, attendee cameras and microphones are muted and will remain so throughout the webinar. But there will be an opportunity for questions from attendees near the end of the experts roundtable session, and those questions should be submitted to the Q&A section at the bottom of your screen, not to the chat section. The chat section is for you to communicate with each other, where you can post matters that are related to this particular subject, and you can share your details with each other. We also welcome you to scroll through the questions and to upvote them. And that is, vote for a question that is up there that you too would like to be addressed. This will help us to focus a bit and give us an opportunity for the panel to answer questions in the time that we have. I would say apologies in advance if we're not able to answer all the questions that come up today. So let's begin with some introductory comments from Jan-Gustav Strandenäs and Professor Raymond Sanner. Jan-Gustav Strandenäs, our first speaker, began working with the UN on environment and governance matters in the 1970s. He's been lecturing at the UN for nearly 50 years. Jan-Gustav, I lost my script again. I should know this all by now, of course. Earlier in his career, Jan-Gustav worked for Norway's foreign office in Botswana and Uganda, and also directed a large NGO in Norway. And Jan-Gustav, most recently responsible for one of Stakeholder Forum's projects, the Towards Stockholm Plus 50 stakeholder consultation for the Stockholm Plus 50 conference this past June. Jan-Gustav, with that introduction, I'll now hand the floor over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles. Thank you for your kind introduction. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are on this planet. We are now in 2023, halfway through to 2030, which in 7.5 years will be an important year for reflection and analysis. We are also halfway through analyzing and discussing the SDGs in our series on the SDG countdown to the September summit this year. And with today's SDG pair, we have discussed 8 of the 17 SDGs. We are now focusing on SDG 7 and SDG 8 and have outlined a number of the challenges that relate to these SDGs in a concept note, which is available to all. The label for SDG 7, which is stamped across the logo, is simply affordable and clean energy. SDG 8 is attributed to decent work and economic growth. These are abbreviated text, and we always remind our participants of the full titles of each SDG, as abbreviations always miss out on important messages. SDG 7 is about to ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, and modern energy for all. And SDG 8 deals with promote sustained, inclusive, and sustainable economic growth, full and productive employment, and decent work for all. And as we all know and must remember, each of the SDGs is enriched with a number of targets and indicators. In the case of SDG 7, there are 5 targets and 11 indicators. SDG 8 is fitted with 12 targets and 29 indicators. The two SDGs are proof of the interlinked nature of all SDGs. Take accessible energy and relate it to SDG 2 on hunger and agriculture. Without energy, nothing moves and no food can be tilled. No matter how simple or how complicated, no food can be prepared or transported or consumed if energy is missing. Badly managed energy production and consumption will affect SDG 1 on reducing poverty. It will affect SDG 3 on health, SDG 13 on climate, SDG 9 on infrastructure, and it goes to the heart of SDG 8 on economic growth. While energy obviously has been a driver of development, we have turned a blind eye to the negative consequences of the energy industry. Our national and global energy policies have for too long been dramatically short-sighted. We have harnessed energy cheaply and must now pay dearly. The fossil fuel-based economies have caused and are causing enormous expenses, damaging the environment almost beyond repair, with side effects on human and animal health, contributing to growing social divides and still driving growing gaps between the haves and the have-nots, and even straining the economy of all countries. There are dire health consequences from burning of fossil fuels, more than meets the eye. Pneumonia, allergies, stunted growth of children, heart attacks, cancer, brain damage, and more can be traced back to fossil fuel emissions. A recent article from North American research organization NRDC states that scientists have known for years about the deadly impacts of fossil fuel combustion. But a new peer review study published in Environmental Research puts the global death toll at more than twice that of previous estimates. News that air pollution from fossil fuel kills 1 in 5 people is sobering, to say the least. The health cost of energy production based on fossil fuels are also staggering. The economic and health costs of air pollution from burning fossil fuels total nearly $3 trillion in 2018, representing about 3.3% of the global GDP, or about $8 billion per day. With this sum, according to one of the estimates, we would be able to finance the implementation of the entire 2030 agenda with each of the 17 SDGs. It is difficult to grasp the amount of energy consumed worldwide. 83% of the energy we use comes from fossil fuels. For now, most of the increase in global energy consumption will be covered by burning more coal and gas. Since 2000, global energy consumption has increased by about a third and is projected to continue to grow in the foreseeable future. In a business as usual scenario, global energy consumption between 2000 and 2040 will have increased by 77%. Growing energy consumption makes the challenge of transitioning our energy systems away from fossil fuels towards lower carbon sources of energy more difficult. If this increased demand is not offset by improvements in energy efficiency and renewable energies, we are in deep trouble. The good sign in this context is that growth in demand seems to be slowing, averaging about 1 to 2% per year. Renewable energy is on the rise, but is developing too slowly at the moment. Allowing all people accessible and affordable energy will be one of the largest challenges in the years to come, and we must combine energy supplies with solidarity for all. The 2030 agenda is today an incubator for out-of-the-box thinking. An underestimated consequence of the 2030 agenda and the SDGs is that it has created an added value to areas which 20 years ago were not recognized. Be that by industrialists, investors or economists or politicians for that matter. Taking a serious look at discussions around SDG 8 on economic growth and employment, a revolution is taking place. Economists are facing new knowledge barriers. As one exasperated professor said to me once, how am I going to integrate the value of planetary boundaries in lectures on economy when I hardly understand what this is all about, he said. The SDGs have turned upside down all debates, and not the least in economic theory and practice. Keynesian theories, solidly founded in a deep understanding of social contracts with decent employment for all, has long challenged new management theories with free access to unregulated markets. Both of these are now facing ideas on prosperity without growth. The 2030 Agenda focuses on this fundamental question already in the preambular text when identifying prosperity as one of five key values that the SDGs will rest on. The 193 UN member states signing the 2030 Agenda committed back in 2015 to be, and I quote, determined to ensure that all human beings can enjoy prosperous and fulfilling lives and that economic, social, and technological progress occurs in harmony with nature. In 2002, at the World Summit for Sustainable Development, I helped organize a side event on growth-less economies. We were called naive NGOs, and economists left the side event with a smirk on their face. In a debate at the UN in 2014, I was told by a respected representative from a foreign office that the SDGs were not where serious international activities would be about in the future. How wrong these statements were. Rumor has it that when UNEP initiated their programs on green economy and the Green Bank initiatives prior to Rio Plus 20 in 2012, the World Bank people were annoyed. We in civil society, on the other hand, wondered back then if this was a clash of ideologies or a debate of traditionalists versus progressivists. It was evident that those of traditional approaches to economy was challenged by trying to make sense out of involving nature into economic equations. Economic growth had seldomly been questioned as a goal, a necessity for progress and development, and most economists seemed wed to the idea that GDP was an honest, correct, and true measurement of development. After all, the welfare states of the world were all based on this premise. And now, ideas challenging and changing traditional economic theories is a key element in SDG 8. Yes, we need growth, but what kind of growth is needed? And what kind of growth is desired? What will the consequences be for decent employment if and when economic systems are changed? Will the 1% opulent and rich be persuaded to leave their greedy approach to economic development? Will we see a just distribution of wealth and finally be able to eradicate poverty? While at the same time of all this manage to take care of the environment? The three dimensions of sustainable development must support each other in the transitions in a just and equal way. Times and understandings have changed rapidly over a few years, and nations have begun to discuss how to understand and possibly integrate in their plans ideas on circular economy and let new understanding of just employment schemes and economies be elements in their social contracts. In the Secretary General's report to the United Nations in 2021, named Our Common Agenda, the Secretary General Antonio Guterres have stated that, and I quote, now is the time to correct a glaring blind spot in how we measure economic prosperity and progress. When profits come at the expense of people and our planet, we are left with an incomplete picture of the true cost of economic growth. In this context, the United Nations System Chief Executive Boards for Coordination in November 2021 deliberated on measuring progress beyond GDP. Their considerations dealt with the following, and I quote, the simultaneous challenges with which the world is grappling, COVID-19, the climate, biodiversity, pollution crisis, extreme inequalities, shifting globalization dynamics, financial volatility and vulnerability, rapid digital transformation, and the digital and data divides, among others, all this have ignited a broad rethinking of business as usual practices in evaluating the well-being of people and planet. With legitimacy from the 2030 Agenda and the SDGs, a report called Beyond GDP, and one on valuing what counts were produced and made available in the summer of 2022. Their ideas must be part of the discussion in the September summit. Sir Isaac Newton, the famous English scientist active in the first half of the 18th century, once said, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on shoulders of giants." In other words, Newton had realized that earlier work had enabled him to understand more. The 2030 Agenda and the SDGs all rest on work that has preceded it, work that began with a new world order when the UN was founded in 1945, which led to global solidarity initiatives between a growing number of nations in the world, which slowly succeeded in decolonizing the world and at the same time afforded more people more rights, as through the Human Rights Covenants on Social, Economic, and Cultural Rights adopted in 1966. Then we got a focus on the environment in 1972, on sustainable development through first Agenda 21 in 1992, then through Rio Plus 20 in 2012, and finally with the adoption of the 2030 Agenda in 2015. The 2030 Agenda rests on the shoulders of work that preceded it and represents a continuum in efforts to make lives better. I would like to close my introduction with a quote from the Indian philosopher, Nobel Prize Literature Laureate and polymath, Mr. Rabindranath Tagore. He once wrote, "I have become my own version of an optimist. If I can't make it through one door, I'll go through another door, or I'll make a door. Something terrific will come no matter how dark the present." And that is another way of understanding the 2030 Agenda and the SDGs. It is a door to a sustainable future. And that is the vision we must bring to the upcoming SDG summit in September this year. Thank you for your attention.
Jan Gustav, thank you very much, in particular for highlighting just how interlinked the SDGs are and how we forget that and how important it is to think of them that way. I'll now welcome our next speaker, Professor Raymond Sanner, who is titular professor in the economics department at the University of Basel. His research projects focus on sustainable development, international relations, trade, and public administration. Professor Sanner is co-founder of CSEND, a long-established Geneva-based non-governmental research and development organization, accredited by ECOSOC with consultative status, and is an expert working for international organizations, national governments, and civil society organizations. A scholar in the field of international negotiations and conflict resolution, Raymond often works for UN DESA projects relating to the 2030 Agenda and the 17 SDGs. Raymond, you have the floor.
Charles, thank you very much for your kind introduction. Let me try to manage now the sharing of my screen. Which I think I succeeded. Can you see it?
Yes, sir, we can. And if you can enlarge it, that's it. We've got it. Thank you.
I just enlarged it. All right. Great. Well, first of all, hello to everybody. It's a pleasure to share a few minutes with you on this new, the fourth series of the Stakeholder Forum, looking at the SDG 7 and 8. We have a lot of excellent speakers that come after me. I'm not going to go too deep into it. Just wanted to give an overview and also emphasize a few points that I think are important. So first of all, SDG 7. It's energy. And as you know, the SDGs, the 2030 Agenda, basically consists of three interrelated, indivisible dimensions. They're called the social sustainability, environmental sustainability, and economic sustainability. All three are very much affected by energy, by either having access to energy or having access to, unfortunately, polluted energy. Energy is a crucial ingredient to our life and to development in general. Now, there are several targets and indicators. I just want to highlight three. Looking at 7.1, it says we should have universal access to modern energy. 7.2 is to increase global share of renewable energy. And 7.3, double the improvement in energy efficiency. I think these are three very important targets, and I'll say a few things more shortly. If you look at this slide, which we copied from the United Nations Knowledge Platform on SDGs that you can freely download and look at it when you with more leisure and time to look at what's happening at this point when it comes to SDG 7. So you see among just a few things I want to highlight. The lack of access to electricity. Three out of four of them, of these people who don't have access to electricity, live in the region of the sub-Saharan Africa. But also cooking, the way people are left cooking with a form of a petrol derivative, which not only smells bad, it creates a lot of smoke, and it is a health hazard. And a lot of these people, 2.6 billion people, as the estimate goes, are in need of electricity, are in need of better facilities and better ingredients and to do their cooking. Now, what is particularly alarming is if you look at the middle here, where it says the number of people without electricity, they're still enormously high. We're talking about here 679 million people have no access to electricity at all. And when it comes also to financing flows to developing countries so they could have access to renewable, non-polluting energy, you see this is a dropping graph. There is less and less, and has been up to 2019, dropping down. And it is an enormously important moment when we discuss in New York also the financing for development, that this aspect here gets to be included in our discussions, how to finance renewable energies in the developing world. Now, what kind of renewable energies is available at the global level? You see a progression, it's positive. And you see here also what kind of renewable energies have been made available. The yellow part here is mostly solar energies. Then you have bioenergy, hydropower. That's the whole grouping of renewable energy. But mind you, renewable energy is still, compared to fossil fuel, it's still a clear minority in terms of sources of energy. We have to do much more to replace the fuel energies because they are the prime cause of climate change. So in terms of transition, I'd say when it comes to going towards a more reasonable, more renewable energy future, there is a lot of the skilled gaps and shortages, which are still there. They're increasing to some extent, and they're likely widespread across countries unless we have more proactive measures to counter this trend of not of being basically stuck with fossil based energy and not move into more renewable energy. In high-income countries, including those even with well-developed skills, a lack of both technical and transferable core skills remains a significant recruitment barrier for employers. While in the developing countries, it's especially challenged by the deficiency of higher skills levels. At the bottom in red, it says, this represents a critical barrier for many low-income countries where university graduates and high-level skills in general tend to be in short supply. This may constitute a constraint on the net zero transition, the hope to move towards a carbon-free net zero future. Well, decent work and economic growth, when it comes to eight focuses on growth and also both labor on decent work. There are 12 targets, 17 indicators. I'd like to say the following. this slide I've shown you already. Here again, I would like to emphasize three of the targets, and that's 8.1, to move towards sustainable economic growth. You know, most of the time when we talk about sustainability, people are immediately thinking of environment, which is fine. It's a core ingredient, could say, aspect of sustainability. But without sustainable economic growth, it will not be possible to avoid that we still will be impacting negatively the environment. We should also have a meaningful, sustained economic growth. 8.4, to improve resource efficiency in consumption and production. The way we produce goods, the way of our lifestyle, the way we impact the environment. And 8.5 is full employment and decent work with equal pay. Now, according to the 2020 SDG report, all of the targets under SDG 8 were heavily, severely affected by COVID-19. I think we all experienced this in our countries. People were laid off. Productivity was shrinking. The supply chains were disrupted. It had an enormous impact on labor and human beings. And if you look here again at the United Nations platform, which indicates the current state of the different targets, one thing that's very important is here to see that even though there has been an improvement from the most difficult period of the COVID pandemic, it is starting again to drift off, partially because of the Ukraine war and its impact on food systems, but also in general about the supply system as such. And one more thing here I'd like to highlight on the left, upper left corner, we have in some areas, again, other forms of health issues, pandemics, rising inflation, I mentioned already supply chain disruptions, policy in uncertainties, because oftentimes our governments don't quite know how to tackle inflation, supply chain disruptions, labor market challenges. So there is a lot of uncertainty facing also the target 8, and my colleagues will speak more about SDG 8 shortly. Just like to say that achieving SDG 8 in Asia, for instance, would mean to stop or to reduce exploitative labor practices, especially in industries which lie on the informal sector. Well, basically, when it comes to our economies, in many countries, the informal sector is very high. Informal sector also means people working in the informal sector are much more vulnerable from being exploited by whoever hires them to do a job. Now, economic growth does not automatically create jobs. If it does, those jobs may not be decent, especially when it comes to the informal economy. The targets under SDG 8 cover two of the four dimensions of decent work. Social protection and social dialogue are not included, are excluded, meaning they are not sufficiently addressed. And again, my colleagues will talk about this shortly. Now, what I wanted to also highlight is when it comes to decent work and economic growth, promote sustainable, inclusive and sustainable economic growth, full and productive employment and decent work for all as much as that's possible in the current conditions. Now, here is my, in a way, conclusion. I'd like to focus on the transitions that we need to plan and that we need to start through creating synergies and to limit negative trade-offs. What I'm showing you here is a graphical a slide, which is based on the Global Sustainable Development Review, the one that was done and published in 2019. You see on the left side in a vertical manner are all the 17 goals. And again, the 17 are also horizontally across from left to right. my arrows here indicate the impact that one goal has on another goal. And here in particularly is seven impacting eight up here, seven down here. You see about a quarter of this circle is in beige, meaning it indicates there are trade-offs, meaning there are, in other words, some complications versus it's not just simply synergistic that the two goals work well together. There are things that need to be addressed when the two the two goals are put into more closer scrutiny as to how to get the two of them to become more synergistic. You have a trade-off, just as an example, if in countries, for instance, hunger is a very important need to address, the government might want to address it by using more pesticides in agriculture. The more pesticides are used, on one hand, maybe the crop production increases, but at the same time, the environment is hit by an increase of pollution. Synergistic will be both whatever is being done in one with one goal also benefits another goal. For instance, when it comes to purifying water, if the water that's being used for industrial production of goods by industry, if it is purified and when it is let go into river systems and water systems, it doesn't lead to pollution, it doesn't lead to health difficulties for the people who are dependent on clean water. Now, I'll give you an example. For instance, when it comes to renewable energy, there are now discussions, and in Morocco, it's actually already being implemented, how to create solar farms. You see here a picture of one of these solar farms. The idea is in the Sahara region, in the deserts, basically, where there is plenty of sun, of course, these solar farms will produce electricity that would be then transported over to Europe, which is a very strong, of course, consumer of energy and electricity. So the idea would be to produce in Africa and then to consume in Europe. Now, theoretically speaking, it could make sense. The question is here, particularly looking at SDG 8, who will work in these solar farms? What will be the working conditions? And also, who will really benefit from such solar farms? Are the farmers themselves, can they also have access to technology such as solar renewable energy? Are they left sort of on the side because the production, as I've shown you here, is so mega, so huge, which also means an enormous capital investment is needed, which could also lead to basically a very consolidated ownership in the hands of a few multinational companies. It's known that they are then producing energy, electricity for the main market versus for the local market, for the farmers, for the people in the cities in the Saharan region. They might be cut off from any benefit. And so we should really address to what extent could the locals also benefit from renewable energy. And that has another component to it when it comes to the renewable energy. We should also be mindful that some of the solar energy, for instance, the panels, have to be replaced after some years of use. Some of it is highly chemical, highly toxic. Who plans for the moment when solar panels have to be replaced? Who will do the replacement? It could be a rather also difficult job or even a dangerous job to do. Who will be taking care of that? So it's more than just simply talk about renewable energy. We should also look at it to have a sustainable form of renewable energy. Also, be mindful that if you have built up a solar farm, as here is the case from Puerto Rico. If there is a terrible storm, this whole farm could be damaged dramatically, as you can see it on the picture that I'm showing you. So we have to also take other factors into account when we invest, when we produce, to also include the potential inevitable crisis when all this might be destroyed or partially needs to be replaced. There is a lot of possibilities. I've published an e-book on this myself. When it comes to maybe local users, maybe we could find a way to agree for a green trims, the trade-related investment measures. So we have renewable energy made available for the locals to have more green trips, meaning intellectual property rights that also would be shared with the local society and local entrepreneurs, and to have a more meaningful combination of working on energy, on environment, on trade and development between developed and developing countries. There's a lot of talk about going into the next wave of renewable energy or of better energy, saying to go into the hydrogen version of energy. And you see listed all the fancy new terms that are being used. It's very technical, high tech. And again, that leads us to the possibility that we don't have enough understanding how to make these new development, new technologies, which could be very beneficial for renewable energy and carbon-free economies, how to make it synergistic. So as I give you here the picture that I took myself when I was working in Burundi, to have let others benefit from the new technologies that are being right now invented, constructed, but are highly concentrated on the already developed countries. We have to figure out a way to have a trickle down of these new energies to the rest of the world so we can help everybody to get on board for a sustainable future. Thank you very much.
Raymond, thank you especially for linking our two subjects together and for digging deeply into the goals within the goals. And also, just to say to our audience, we'll be sharing the presentation with you. And Raymond Conley put in the actual addresses for some of those reports and charts, so you'll be able to dig into them deeply yourself. Raymond, thank you again. So it's time for us now to move on to our next section, which will be moderated by my colleague, David O'Connor. So I'd like to first mention that David is a fellow of Stakeholder Forum and the permanent observer at the United Nations of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, the IUCN. Previously, David held the United Nations team supporting, David led the UN team supporting substantively the UN General Assembly Open Working Group that crafted the Sustainable Development Goals. Before that, David worked for many years at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, Development Center in Paris, addressing sustainable development challenges of emerging economies. He holds a degree from the University from University College London, University of Wisconsin at Madison, and Yale University in Connecticut. David, thank you for joining us and for moderating today. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Charles. Can people hear me, I hope?
Yes, we hear you fine. Thank you.
Great. Okay, well, what I want to do is just dive in immediately to introducing our stellar panel. But before I do that, I just wanted to remind everyone on the call that this year, as Jan Gustav pointed out, is the midway point of the SDGs, but it's also the point where we need to figure out how we're going to accelerate progress going forward, because as several of the speakers have already mentioned, the pandemic has set back progress in some areas, but we weren't making sufficient progress in many areas already. And now we have only 7 years, 7.5 years left to realize the SDGs. And that will require concerted efforts by all. It will require significant financing, scaling up of financing, and technology cooperation, and so on. And so we'll hear a bit about what has been happening in the SDG 7 and SDG 8 space, and hopefully with a forward look at how we open new doors or create doors, as Jan Gustav said, quoting Rabindranath Tagore. So our first speaker today will be Dr. Minoru Takada. He is the Sustainable Energy Team Leader and the head of the UN Energy Secretariat based in the Division for Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs. Previously, he was a driving force behind the Sustainable Energy for All initiative of the United Nations Secretary General, whose objectives actually inspired the SDG 7 and the targets thereof. They are almost a carbon copy of the goals, the targets of the Sustainable Energy for All initiative. And Dr. Takada will talk about progress on SDG 7 and how it is interlinked with progress in other areas, as well as reflect, and this is most important, on what remains to be done to accelerate progress on SDG 7 as an accelerant of progress across the SDGs between now and 2030. So you have the floor, Dr. Takada. Hello, Minoru.
Hi, David. Thank you very much for the kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be joining this wonderful sort of conversation with so many colleagues connecting from many parts of the world. This year is very special for energy, SDG 7 year. We have SDG 7 review coming up at high-level political forum in July, and then leading into what's once in a four-year SDG summit in September. That is going to be also coming together with the Secretary General's Climate Ambition Summit in September. And then end of the year, we'll have UNFCCC COP28, and where we do expect energy is going to be a very hot subject. So internationally, energy is under the spotlight once again. So what are we expecting here this year? So one, we need to identify gap. We are in the midpoint, and then there will be sort of, need to be accelerating. So we have to identify the gap. And secondly, we need to have some ideas as to how to address these gaps. And thirdly, and this is going to be very important this year, mobilize partnership and actions. I think those three things need to come as a set. Otherwise, we will not be able to actually create much better forward-looking momentum on that. Let me explain on that one. To actually understand the gaps and the potential opportunities, the DESA is supporting a series of consultations. We'll be doing very soon online consultation targeting all stakeholders around the world to listen to them as to what they think about challenges and what they think about potential opportunities that global community should become. So please do expect that this is going to come into your way, and look forward to having your voices to be reflected as we try to bring good input into the conversation toward SDG 7 review at high level political forum this year. Secondly, consolidation of those issues and ideas will happen at the global expert group meeting that we'll be having in New York in the middle of May. So by that time, we would have synthesized ideas, be ready to have some more in-depth discussion to sharpen key messages to be sent to the high-level political forum. Now, the things are on the way, but let me highlight a few things already coming up. In terms of gap, right? SDG 7 is a mixed scenario right now. I think already, the presenters already pointed out some of the sort of challenges areas. Good news is that electrification is going on relatively smoothly, and some countries started doing massively. So access to electricity It's catching up quite well. Not to the extent that gets to the universal access by 2030, but it is getting quite there. And with a lot of options coming up, particularly off-grid and the mini-grid renewable energy-based solutions being deployed around the world, there is a hope that further acceleration on the electrification is a possibility. But I would like to hear from you or from audience with this. Second good part is renewable energy. Renewable energy is going extremely strong. In fact, and out of these crises that we went through and have been through right now, renewable energy came out as a winner. And they're very resilient. A lot of investment happening. We don't see any turning back. So question is going to be how to accelerate even more so we'll be able to not only significantly increase renewable, but also be close to 1.5 degree pathway. There are not good news. Energy efficiency is not going as quickly as we would have liked. So it needs to go further. And in fact, we need to almost double the rate of improvement compared with where we are standing. So it's a significant sort of improvement is needed on energy efficiency. And then the most problematic area right now is clean cooking solutions. Unfortunately, 2.4 billion people are still not having access to clean cooking solutions. Huge economic and health impacts on it, all the people who are using that. So we have to do something about it. On 2021, Secretary General convened the High Level Dialogue Energy, pointing that on this problem, saying that by 2025, global community needs to add 1 billion additional people with access to clean cooking solutions. Enormous challenges, but also giving some fruitful thoughts as to the opportunities here, which brings to our opportunities here. What are the things that we need to do here? Number one, accelerating universal access. This is fundamental. We have to finish this universal access agenda by 2030 because we have a long way to go in terms of energy transitions toward 2050. But 2030 universal access is the first definite stop for everybody. So we must be extremely serious about it, both on the electrification side as well as cooking solutions side. Second, let's build on the momentum that renewable energy is creating. And then we build on that and expand, particularly off-grid last mileage solutions. Lastly, we can actually expand energy efficiency solution hand-in-hand renewable energy. This combination works extremely well, evidence shows. So what are the things that we have to do in doing so? One thing that we have to think about is we borrow the narrative of just energy transition moving forward. There is going to be no just energy transition without achieving universal energy access, period. We cannot think about transitioning when people do not have even access to start with. So this is a point that developing countries and all stakeholders, international community must ensure is part of, on central part of any just energy transitions to come. And UNFCCC will start discussing about content of just transition. We must make sure this is going to be part of it. And then secondly, there needs to be a specific focused initiative to scale up and also bring the political commitment to make sure there's going to be higher momentum to come. So this is why 2023 is very pivotal in that. Not only do we have SDG 7 review, we have SDG summit at the heads of states level. I can say that at the Secretary General's office level, they are calling for what they call high impact initiative to be accompanying SDG summit. We at the UN system are supporting the preparation of potential high impact initiative, building on some of the area of the work just I just mentioned. So these are the things that I think we need to be able to, you know, all the, you know, do that to move things forward and the, you know, initiative and the multi-stakeholder partnerships are central elements of whether we can actually make a difference over the next 7.5 years to achieve SDG 7 moving forward. So at this, we look forward to having the many cooperations with all kinds of stakeholders as we move forward. David, if you allow me, I will stop here and for further discussion later down.
Thank you, Minoru. Thanks very much for that presentation. I think we will shall return to this question of just transition in the discussions. But I just wanted to quote, following up on your point, that there's no just transition without universal access, which is, of course, absolutely fundamental. In a study done by David Victor and company a couple of years ago, they say that, quote, a just transition is a desirable goal in itself. It may also be the only kind of low carbon transition that can be sustained. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an added point to yours about universal access. And I look forward to hearing more in the Q&A about this high impact initiative that you have in the works, because I think it'd be nice to get a little bit more specific on that. Okay, so next we have a video presentation, short video presentation by an expert who unfortunately is chairing a defense of a doctoral dissertation at the moment. One of those things that I'm sure many of you have had the pleasure of experience in your lives. So we have Dr. Francesco Fuso Nerini, an associate professor in the Division of Energy Systems and director of the KTH Climate Action Center at the Royal Institute of Technology in Sweden. And he's the co-author of a recent article exploring linkages of SDG 7 to the other SDGs. And he will reflect on that research in this video. Charles, could you please play the video? Thank you. Sorry, can people hear this?
David, are you not hearing it? I've paused it for a moment, David. Can you hear it?
No, I cannot hear it. And others cannot hear it either, Charles. I don't know what's going on.
Well, let me try something different. I have it both as a download and as a from the web.
Okay, let me just come in and mention to people that they need to just be patient.
Okay.
So hello, everyone. We're having a little bit of a technical problem, but we're going to try another solution so that everyone can hear the video. And failing that, we'll have to move on. But hopefully, Charles will be able to sort it out with his technical expertise. Give us just a few seconds.
David, I'm going to start it again. Let me know if you're hearing it, please.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. My name is Francesco Fusonerini.
Need to turn up the volume. Yes, I can hear it, but need to turn up the volume.
Director of the KTH Climate Action Center. And today I would like to talk about our work on systems and trade-offs between energy and the Sustainable Development Goals. And first of all, I would like to start with a couple of words about our center at KTH in Sweden, where we work on looking at how to achieve the climate action goals, so both climate adaptation and mitigation, in synergy with all the other SDGs, both by collaborative research in our universities and key partners, but also with the key collaborations that can enable getting research into societal action. And jumping in the topic of today, as you know, since the creation of the Sustainable Development Goals in 2015, a lot of work has been ongoing to understand how to use these global goals in practice, so to frame and direct research, policy, and projects. And today I would like to focus in on one of the studies that we've done, looking at the interconnections between the energy goals and all the other sustainable development goals. Or in other words, how the goal 7 on affordable and clean energy is connected and depends on all the other goals. In practice, I won't talk too much about the methodology for this study, but we had a large transdisciplinary author group that in practice, if you see the supplementary material, there's a large table and we did 169 small studies, let's say like that, expert-driven, literature-based studies to understand the connection of each, between each one of these 169 targets and SDG 7 and in general energy systems. Here you can see a summarized version of our results. And in this paper, you can see in the outer wheel, we have all the sustainable development goals. Each one of these smaller circles represents a target. So for instance, this will be SDG 1, target 1. And when there is a highlighting between, let's say, the target and the center of this figure, it means that we found either a synergy between achieving SDG 7 and that specific target, or a trade-off. As you can see in this figure, we identified evidence of interlinkages between SDG 7 and at least 85% of all targets, 143 targets. And as you can see here, there are more than twice as many synergies between SDG 7 and the other targets here on the left than trade-offs on the right. But of course, I will also discuss a bit that it doesn't matter too much how many synergies and trade-offs there are, but more the local specificity. So in some cases, a trade-off might be more important for, let's say, for a specific energy project than 20 synergies. Classical example, if you're in a country where 20, 30, 50% of your GDP depends on fossil fuels, advancing on energy efficiency and renewable energy will create some frictions. Starting from the synergies, again, we see that SDG 7 has synergies with 85% of all targets. In other words, affordable and clean energy underpins all the SDGs. So these synergies are on all levels. For instance, for the 1.1 billion people, 700 million people lacking modern electricity access, and for the nearly 3 billion people still using traditional fuels for cooking, modern energy access will support achieving several goals. So energy access is needed for hospitals, for schools, for water and sanitary systems to work properly. And access to modern fuels can substitute polluting fuels for cooking that harms billions of people every day. And of course, SDG 7 has synergies also with many environmental goals, from protecting ecosystems to fighting climate change and localized pollution. Let's take an example. In cities like, let's say, New Delhi, air pollution caused mostly by energy conversion processes is so high that locals are advised not to practice sports for the severe consequences it might have on their health. On the other hand, low polluting energy sources and energy efficiency can improve massively these conditions, while at the same time tackling some of the most pressing environmental issues of our times. And here you can see the results on the trade-offs that we found. So there are potential trade-offs between SDG 7 and the delivery of the other SDGs. I made an example of an economic trade-offs. But also, when we look at, for instance, renewable energy projects, if not planned properly, can have important trade-offs. So a classic example is, for instance, hydropower, a very important renewable energy source to achieve our climate goals. However, large hydropower dams can have impacts on local ecosystems, can require displacing people, creating trade-offs with the local development. Or another example is when we talk about biofuels, the competition with the food systems, and so on. So the bottom line here is that it is extremely important to understand for each and every energy project or policy, not only the synergies, but also its potential trade-offs with the SDGs. to then act accordingly to minimize trade-offs and maximize synergies. Because as you can imagine, these trade-offs are the ones that ultimately may stop your SDG 7 project from being approved and implemented. So the next step that we are doing in our research group, but also in other research groups, is how to use with this global understanding of interlinkages and connections between energy systems and the SDGs to then look at the local level and decide on projects and policies. Here you can see some of the references from this work. And more broadly, we see there is a bit of a gap in sustainability assessments, where you have traditional environmental assessments that are more local and more focused on, let's say, environmental aspects. And there is some work to do to integrate all the SDGs into a more broad sustainable development assessment. And from our side, we've been working in creating tools and procedures to support this kind of assessments, for instance, for projects. And I'll just show you one example to be a bit more specific. So, for instance, we have evaluated the sustainability of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam in light of all the 169 targets of the SDGs. And as you can see, this is quite a controversial project. So it's a large hydropower project, very central for local green growth and electricity access. But also it's controversial for issues about water rights, community relocations, and other issues. And what we have done is that we have created an open source tool where, based on a number of questions about a specific project, here is pre-filled for this project, so which type of energy source it is, renewable, non-renewable. We say it's a hydro project in a certain type of country. And then a number of questions about the project. So here we can run, let's say, this model, and then quite quickly see how this project might have synergies or trade-offs here in a graphic format with all the targets of the SDGs, and also access this type of information to then do something about it. And so running this tool that now any project developer can use, we can see quite quickly an overview of how that specific project might impact local sustainable development. And so without going too much in detail due to lack of time, we can quickly see how this project has synergies with the SDGs due to increasing electricity access in the region, replacing traditional fossil fuels, but also some key trade-offs that need to be addressed, such as on transboundary water use conflicts and disruption of ecosystems. Well, more broadly, work is ongoing to try to see how to use the SDGs to advance SDG 7 at a local level. And if any of you is interested, I would be happy to have a further dialogue on this. Here in this slide, you can see my contact, we will also share our slides. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for that. Although you can't hear us, Francesco, that was a very interesting presentation. And what I particularly liked about it was this development of a tool that can actually link projects to the SDGs and the linkages across SDGs, the analysis of the different synergies and trade-offs. I think it's a very valuable tool, and I'm sure you'll get multiple requests from project designers and implementers to be able to make use of it. So without further ado, thank you again. And we're going to move on to our next set of presenters. And we're going to begin with, this is on SDG 8 primarily now. SDG 8 primarily. We're going to begin with Mr. Kari Tapiola, who is the former Deputy Director General and Executive Director of the International Labor Organization, ILO. Before joining the ILO, where he has worked for many years, he worked as the International Secretary of this Central Organization of Finnish Trade Unions, and also as the General Secretary of the Trade Union Advisory Committee to the OECD in Paris. In his professional life, Mr. Tapiola has dealt with questions of international labor standards and fundamental principles and rights at work, multinational enterprises, the social and labor effects of globalization, technological change and industrial relations, and the social and labor issues in countries in transition. So without further ado, I pass it to you, Mr. Tapiola.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I can. Yes.
Okay. So then I can continue or start rather. You know, if you look at SDG 8, it is actually about the socioeconomic shape of our economies in general. It's a little bit like what the ILO was in 1919. In the Versailles Peace Treaty after the First World War. It's a little bit also like the emphasis on labor management relations, tripartite cooperation, social dialogue in reconstruction after World War II. The problem that we have is that after the Cold War, and for the last 30 years with globalization, we have not had a recognizable or recognized similar deal, economic and social deal, or a deal with the social dimension. We have been generally following a markets first approach, where the social dimension then comes next, maybe. And inadvertently, I think it's inadvertent, but even the structure of goal number 8 and its numerous subpoints reflect this growth first, social measures then priority. Now, the problems of underdevelopment after decolonization and the rush to the market after the collapse of totalitarian communist systems, or rather the rush to the market after since the Reagan-Thatcher days, is that you accept this order of things. The economic first, growth first, and then eventually maybe social labor issues. I think one example shows how misleading this is and can be. And that is the example of child labor, which became a global issue once the world economy started arranging itself among supply chains, and once trade walls started coming down. There was and continues to be a belief that child labor is caused by poverty. And of course, child labor is linked to poverty. But that leads into thinking that first you need to have growth, any kind of growth, and then you can afford a situation where children don't have to work. Now, this ignores the fact that by persisting, child labor itself perpetuates poverty and is a serious drag on not only human but also economic development. The same misconcept about the link between growth and the social dimension you find with discrimination. Discrimination perpetuates poverty. Forced labor is not productive or advantageous. Ignoring freedom of association and the possibilities of collective bargaining rights constrains seriously the potential of enterprises and the human resources that can be mobilized for enterprise and economic development. We have had a kind of a weak consensus in the post-Cold War period, but that you need to have both growth and social measures, social protection, employment go hand in hand. But that has not been sufficiently operationalized, and I think that there is continues to be a serious political problem with that. SDG number 8 does have both elements of this, what I would call a compromise: the role of enterprises, recognizing that you cannot have growth and employment growth without proper enterprise development, and the need to have sustainable enterprises. Before 1991-92, in the ILO, for instance, there was no consensus really on the job-creating and economically beneficial role of private enterprises for political, ideological, and other reasons. A consensus since the 90s has been that you should promote private enterprise activity and you should respect international labor standards, fundamental rights at work. Now, the second half of this equation is continuously neglected, willfully or not, just maybe happens to fall out. But this is one of the serious reasons why we are not getting, why we are not reaching the social, the sustainable development goals. As the Secretary General of the United Nations said last week, it's not working. We need a rescue effort. We're not going to achieve full employment by 2030. This year will probably raise world unemployment by another 100 million. We've lost the momentum on child labor. Child labor has started increasing again, partly but not only due to the COVID pandemic. Half of the world's population, 4 billion, is without effective social protection, and energy provisions are disrupted by war, wars that make bad things worse. Maybe in a certain way, the crisis is an opportunity to switch to alternative energy sources. Usually people do things only when they are forced to. But we have also experienced this vulnerability to a global pandemic, which is also an environmental problem. An environmental question, especially concerning the global working environment, unsafe, unclean working and living conditions are conditions that affect health seriously. This is one of the logics of the international labor standards which have been adopted by the ILO over the last 100 plus years. Now, not everything is gloom and doom. We need to tick off the positive achievements and potential of using SDGs, and we have already had good examples. We have good initiatives like the Secretary General's Global Acceleration for Jobs and Social Protection for Just Transition. There you have the right things in, I would say, right order. Ever since 2009, the ILO has been trying to implement the Global Jobs Pact, which is mentioned in SDG number 8. I would say, you know, we know all the solutions. There's nothing really new in terms of the problems. The problem is implementation. And that is very often either a question of political will or a question of political or economic power. The Global Alliance, we have there's this Global Alliance 8.7, which refers to point 7 in the point 7 on forced labor. It has produced promising action. And one of the lessons with that action is that action can be successful when it's integrated. When you look at the different elements that you need to bring together. I already said earlier that forced labor is not productive. Our experience in doing away with forced labor in the cotton industry in Uzbekistan shows that it can be done by promoting decent working conditions and productivity. Bangladesh and other places with large industrial catastrophes, where a lot of lives have been lost, have shown how you need to, at the same time, apply measures for health and safety and enable workers to control their working environment. Occupational safety and health and good workplace relations simply go hand in hand. This is, as I said, the essence of ILO standards, but it also means that you need to integrate the employers and the workers in implementing them. One industry where this all seems to be coming together is fishing. There's new technology, but there still is old exploitation. In addition, there we can see that unregulated and substandard fishing tends to empty the oceans of fish and has a very negative environmental aspect. So, I'll finish by saying.
Okay, thank you.
The SDGs call for integrated policy packages, responsible business management, decent labor standards, especially occupational safety and health, an environmental regulatory framework, collective bargaining, social dialogue. You see, in order to turn jobs green and energy efficient, it has to be done from the inside out, not from the outside. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tapiola. Thanks. That's very interesting. You mentioned fishing, which is a good segue to our next speaker, who is on the ground in the developing country in the Philippines, working on building enterprises, agro-fishery enterprises with small fishers and farmers. So we have Mr. Ivan Idrovo, the CEO of SDC Asia and an external consultant to the ILO. SDC Asia designs, manages, and implements cost-effective and market-driven rural and urban enterprise development programs geared toward the creation of an environment that will enable women and men in marginalized and developing areas to have equitable command and access to the necessary resources for self-development and growth. Mr. Idrovo has more than 20 years of experience in the conduct of detailed value chain analysis of various agri-fishery subsectors in Asia, Southeast Asia, and Central and South America. And so he'll focus on SDG 8 and its interlinkages with other SDGs. So please, Ivan, you have the floor. Ivan, are you there?
Ivan, you're muted.
Yeah, I was muted, sorry. Oh, thank you so much, David, and thank you to all for having me on board. Yes, I will try to honor what David has already introduced about me and my work, and basically trying to bring up a little bit a fresher perspective from the fields. As a practitioner, I've been deeply engaged in different programs trying to see how the different AGDs can really help in bringing up all of these potential solutions to those in the really need. And perhaps I would like to focus a little bit more in the SDG-A, since most of the job lately has been done together with the ILO. And then, of course, as SDG-A calls for all countries, in policymakers, as well as the stakeholders engaged in this global supply and value chains to promote sustained, inclusive, and sustainable economic growth in such a way that it would be full and productive, but at the same time, it would be under decent work conditions. That really requires, or there's a need for more stronger policy interventions at the institutional level, and as well as support that can enable these countries to achieve the SDG-A by 2030. And by applying a strategy that has to be more human-centered, I think so this is a perspective what approach that helps how we can see the future work, and by emphasizing the needs of the society as a whole, because we have to look at what are the needs of the different level of people, a different level of incomes as well, all together with the environment. And there is where the interlink between the SDG 8 and 7 actually comes from. Then the three dimensions, if you want to say, of sustained, inclusive, and sustainable growth, require a strong and consistent efforts to address these challenges. And I believe, aside of the GDP, that we are not about to really meet the target of 7%. We are quite below 4% in most of the countries when it comes to growth. And it's I think so the forecasts are showing us that it could be even worse during the 2023, if ever some sort of economic turn down will materialize. It could be really way below the bar. And then we should start looking at reducing informality. I think my colleagues who have spoken already, they were also clearly stating that informality is causing poverty and preventing people even to participate gainfully in better markets and activities, economic activities. And the progress there is very poor. And also, informal employment is being, you know, very way at the lack, specifically keeping this status quo with more than 60%, according to the ILO, more than 61% actually of workers in the world are still working in an informal work. So that means not enjoying of any kind of decent work and sometimes even minimum living conditions. And that needs to be further addressed. And then, of course, access to financing, and that's another issue. Access to financial services has been, I think, so one among the criteria that has been discussed 50 years or more ago, but somehow we couldn't manage to really bring down the funds that are needed when it comes to achieving not only the SDGs, but also economic and developing in these areas. The unemployment is too high as well in many countries, and there are gender gaps and decent work deficits that are still prevalent and persistent in the country. The situation has been aggravated, especially for women, young people, and people with disabilities that are at the greatest disadvantage, with people, young people, perhaps facing the major decent work deficits in all countries worldwide. ILO also is very clear in stating that respect for workers' rights and compliance with labor standards are the key foundation for decent work. So we cannot achieve that if it's not through respect of workers' rights as well as social justice. And then according to the ILO and other data available, we can see that measuring progress in this dimension, as this SDG 8 specifically shows, that although child labor, for instance, if we talk about something that was already mentioned, has declined in a global level. However, by 2025, that has been targeted or settled for this relevant target to happen, it wouldn't be possible if there is not a strong action that would be not only a consensus, but are working together on how we can implement better policies and programming that will help to eradicate both child labor and forced labor. Failure to make serious progress in achieving SDG 8 indicators will prevent also progress towards other goals, including, for instance, the eradication of poverty, SDG 1, and then ensuring good health and well-being that will be all together with SDG 8, but also SDG 3. And then achieving gender equality is interlinked, interrelated with from SDG 5. And reducing inequalities from SDG 10. So we might tend to believe that it should be noticed that progress in other SDGs will definitely have an impact, or there can be a precondition if we want to advance compliance to SDG 8. Experience shows also that while economic growth and development can happen or can be achieved without poverty alleviation or poverty eradication from SDG 1, poverty eradication cannot be achieved without economic growth and development. So that is the formula of the equation we would like to further explore. And then ILO has stated, I think so very clear, that growth cannot be also sustained if there is only approaches that are based in mostly cyclical demands, meaning to say those countries that are receiving orders or perhaps just exporting natural resources, which is both environmentally not friendly and not economically viable, and or a pure factor of accumulation. Now the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. So the imbalance is also affecting the development. And rather, sustained work requires a structural transformation. And this has been discussed, but not yet put it in place. Diversification, innovation, all of these are aspects that needs to be not only further discussed, but putting in action in concrete policies, and then from that programming that can really target these challenges. And then achieving in the long term growth in productivity requires also that income, that the gains from that, it would be more equitable distributed, because income levels and decent work opportunities are working together. Now, the higher the income level, the better it would be. The working opportunities as well as the decent work conditions. SDG 8 also calls for progress on multiple other complementary targets under different SDGs, like SDG 7, for instance, which is the provision of reliable and clean energy. Without that, health would be at stake. And also from SDG 9, with the delivering of quality and resilient infrastructure and industrialization to accelerate a structural transformation. So those are key points at the policy level that need to be somehow further strengthened and discussed in order to come up with specific interventions, rather than keep so long the discussion that tends to be more in a political level rather than the famous trickle down that everybody's saying that didn't work, and then putting down into the means that will really help the people in the need in improving progress to, in other cases, progress to SDG 10. If you want to reduce inequalities, it's also likely that we have to ensure that productivity gains, once again, will translate into a higher income and more equitable distribution of the wages and working conditions. Sustainable economic growth, we believe, is therefore a result of a successful integration of the economic, the social, the environmental targets in a well-balanced manner, which is sometimes hard not only to understand, but how much more to achieve at the end. However, in general, we all can agree that achieving higher income is really the direct impact that we can cause and contribute to improve performance on SDG 8 specifically. And we, from the perspective of practitioners, have been working so far in coming up with methodologies and approaches that can truly help. And then ender poverty, extreme poverty, or as SDG stated, reducing poverty, eradication of poverty, has been the goal of everybody. It has been the goal of, and the challenge actually of policymakers, stakeholders, countries, all people engaged. And they all agree that there is a need of a more broader-based economic growth in achieving this goal. But the question always relates, okay, what does it mean exactly, broad-based economic growth? of course, especially if you want to understand what needs to be done and how we can ensure that that economic growth will be, or that economic programming is benefiting those in the need, and what the scale is really requires to make a difference in achieving sustainable development. Increasingly, we have been seeing that the answer is becoming the market systems approach that incorporates the value chain approach in such a way that you are trying to look at the systemic constraints that are preventing the opportunities existing in a market system in a given economic environment that are preventing for those less developed or in the need of more support to participate, gainfully participate. And that could be even before you can come up with any implementation or policy in place. An example of this that lately we are developing with ILO and so many other organizations is the Green Job Lens. If we can be sure that we can show that the shift to resilience in low carbon economies must come in hand with inclusive and sustainable growth through identifying and unlocking green employment opportunities for everyone. There are challenges, of course, and greening the work, greening the economies, and to preserving the jobs and securing the resilience of economies for future jobs is very challenging, but can vary across the different countries and depending also on the structure and the sector, and sometimes the institutional, as we mentioned before, institutional arrangements, as well as in the levels of development of the composition of the sectors we are talking about. But green jobs can help definitely companies in preventing also that the climate change will affect in such a way that there would be losing jobs. Now it's been proved that impact of climate change can cause job losses, disrupt the functioning of the economy, that system that was mentioned, global supply and value chains, and then damage the infrastructure even that was created in the labor markets. On the other hand, climate adaptation and mitigation measures can also help themselves to be a source of job creation. So if we look at job in business that can produce goods or provide services that benefits the environment and at the same time preserve or help to conserve the natural resources, is kind of a solution that engage both SDG 7 and 8. These goods and services are, of course, sold to consumers and include research, development, installation, maintenance, and can even cross-cut other sectors. So just to mention quickly some of the approaches, and I know time is gone, so I'd rather stop up here. Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Thank you very much, Ivan. Okay, so We're over time, as you all know, but let's see if anybody's willing to stay, if we can try to address some of the questions that have been posted in the Q&A section. We won't get to all of them. We'll have to combine some. But in any case, there have been questions about financing, and maybe I can direct a question based on the question coming from Krishna on financing to Minoru in the first instance, but others can jump in if you like.
David, could I just suggest that all of our panelists who are still with us, if you'd please activate your cameras, and then if you'd like to speak, then your microphone. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Charles. Yeah, everybody hear that? Good. Okay, so Minoru, a question for you. You have to unmute at the appropriate moment. The IEA, Fatih Birol, the head of IEA, has in a recent speech, I guess, or an article, estimated that renewable energy investments cost two or three or four times as much in emerging economies, not to mention low-income economies, but in countries like Brazil and India as in developed countries. And so, given your emphasis on the need to scale up and accelerate scale up of renewable energy for access and for basically substitution away from fossil fuels, how can this be resolved? What are the solutions we have here to bring down the capital costs so that countries that really need to scale up renewable energy in a big way can afford to do so.
No, thank you. It's a very important point. Thank you very much. I think Fatih is correct. And in some cases, definitely that, you know, still that, you know, the putting together renewable energy, the option could be higher. Although on a global level, and in about 2/3 of the global or the regions, renewable energy appear to be now the cheapest solutions, most cost effective, even lower prices than gas. But still in many developing countries, and the more conditions are difficult, and then renewable energy tend to be higher compared with the conventional options. So couple of things is that A, international community will need to step in to actually go scale. It used to be that renewable energy projects tend to be relatively mid-sized to smaller size. Now that, you know, the scale is proven in all over the world, that bigger scale will significantly reduce the cost. But for that to happen, there needs to be an international cooperation to be able to provide appropriate incentives, enabling conditions, and also some of the sort of guarantee mechanisms of those kind of instruments. So I think it's going to be very important to step up on that one. And then secondly, broadly, very important for it to happen, we need to continue to pressure the global consensus making in that there's a wide, of course, you know, recognition that current financing to developing countries is not at all sufficient to address all the climate action challenges that, and the energy comes at the center of it. So we have to continue to actually advocate for significant scaled up the financing of the, you know, of cooperation, and including reforming of the multilateral or the development financing approaches. So there will be a much better facilitation that international community multilateral system will be able to make things happen in a much sort of accelerated way. But I personally feel that options are getting better and better, looking at the cost decline of, let's say, solar system, for example, last 10 years, so that, you know, like 90% reduction in the cost. So are there more things to come? But yes, challenges cannot be underestimated, particularly for developing countries. We need to work harder to make cooperation happen better.
Okay, thanks. Thank you very much. Let me pose a question now to Kari and Ivan. I don't think we have the benefit of Francesco's being online, unless he's joined somehow. Kari, you know, you in your presentation talked about the growing recognition in the ILO of the need to engage with the private sector and recognize the central role that private enterprises play in creating decent work, creating jobs and decent work. And you have, on the one hand, a group of large multinational corporations, some of whom get that message and understand that they, you know, need to abide by, you know, core labor standards and so on, and make varying degrees of effort to do that. But Ivan is talking about a massive share of the global labor force who are still engaged in informal employment, where this has very little direct impact, honestly. Yet structural transformation, as Ivan pointed out, is essential to giving better opportunities to people who are, I won't say trapped, but basically stuck in the informal sector and have not been able to get their heads above water, so to speak, to have more productive jobs, more productive employment, more decent work, if you will. How do you bring these two worlds together? These are totally different worlds. They're both about SDG 8, but they're entirely different challenges, it seems to me.
Well, somehow supply chains seem to bring these worlds together, at least at the before we started having such a reaction against child labor and forced labor in supply chains. So you had the child labor that went into sporting goods or into other things. They They went from the informal sector and they were exploited in the informal sector. And then they went from there to very formal activities and lots of goods that were sold in the industrialized countries.
Did that transition bring about improvements in their? I mean, this was still child labor who were doing these jobs, if I understand correctly. But child labor working under better conditions, or more or less the same, just in the formal versus the informal sector?
No, it's not only child labor. It started with child labor, and there you have different ways of dealing with it. But I think we have generally, for instance, through the Better Work program, we have been looking at labor standards in general, and there is going to be a bigger emphasis on occupational safety and health, etc. So there's an understanding of that in order to treat or in order to promote this formalization or some degree of formalization of informal work, so you really need to develop standards. But it's not only developing standards, we have all these standards. The question is
yes.
Applying them. The question is applying the standards and having the possibility, having the will of
right.
governments to apply them.
Right, and corporations, of course. So Ivan...
The governments are... governments have signed to these...
right, sure.
So they are legally binding for them.
Right. Well, there are semi-legally binding agreements that multinational corporations have also signed on to. But Ivan, you've been dealing with agro-fisheries, which is basically an informal sector activity for the most part in many countries. And you talk about value chains. How have you been able to assist farmers, fishers, to add value to increase the income which they earn from these activities, to be able to turn them into something more valuable to consumers, to companies that they sell to, whatever? What does that look like, and what are the challenges that you faced?
Okay, thank you, David. The first, I think so, and foremost, everything starts in the market. If there is a product that has been traded, it's been brought up to the market, it's meaning to say it's been controlled and it's been demanded. So there are people that are looking at buying those products, but information on how it has been produced, this has been processed from the very beginning up to the end market, is not being properly addressed, properly controlled, and even transparently communicated. And this is something that is about to be changed even more dramatically. It had already been changed, but now it's going to be totally different because of two main aspects. One is consumers are becoming a little bit more conscious. Communication information right now, as you might notice, is quite at the gate of anybody. The latest generations that are mostly the Z generation and the millennials are more conscious than even us before in selecting the kind of products, in even reading about where it has been produced, who has produced. So that gives a little bit an edge, an advantage on how you can trade better information with companies that are looking at not only performing properly and compliant with laws and most likely some global standards, but also on how they can see that they can profit out of it. So once again, income is the one binding everybody to this game, both companies as well as workers, and those who are perhaps small suppliers that can be rather tapped, trained, skilled up, upgraded, and then after that being participated. The market system approach and the value chain is the one that is providing this room. It's a little bit long, so I will try to keep it short. One is compliance to market requirements, and that can come from both, from the naval environment that is more on the law part, rules that is from local to national level, to regional level, to global level, as well as those who are coming from perhaps social norms even in the countries of operation. And the other one is the support markets, those who are providing exactly those trainings, those services, those business development services that are quite vitally needed for them to improve. These two make a pressure, and right now companies, sorry about what I'm about to say, but it's very difficult to scale. So it's rather looking at the positive perspective. And I think so, they are coming up, and Terry is totally, I think so, right in saying that supply chains are also putting the pressure, even no longer in tier one only, but going beyond.
Right. Great. Great. Thank you. Okay. I'm going to ask a question to Raymond now, because you've talked about, and there was a question.
David, I'm going to have to just jump in. David, we've now gone past 45 minutes.
right. Okay.
We do need to wrap up. So I would like, so I'm going to sort of jump in with executive privilege here, so to speak.
Sure. Go ahead.
And just ask one more question. And then and this is focused on labor. So it'll be something that Yvonne and Kari might want to address. I apologize for not letting others jump in on it, but I'm going to ask this question and ask each of you just to say no more than 1 minute comment on this, and we could dig into it deep further. And then I'm going to have to wrap up, and I will have some closing remarks. So the final question is one that's very timely in the news, and it is, who will save human beings' rights and decent work from the invasion of artificial intelligence and putting policy on controlling the robots? Now, it's big in the news now. Automotive makers are replacing people with robots. Tesla is creating a robot that will be meant to be able to help the elderly rather than a normal healthcare worker. So Yvonne and Kari, if you could each, if you'd like to quick have a comment, no more than a minute. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Shall I go first? And then? Okay, we have been discussing and working on this. Basically, two different areas. While artificial intelligence might pose some risk, it will also bring up new jobs. So we have to look at what are the challenges in facing this transition again. It's like anything, renewable energy will have the same issue. And then the first thing is skills. You cannot have the same workers performing different activities that will require, of course, different skills. So how companies, governments, institutions engage are about to prepare themselves in order to achieve this upgrading and upscaling on the skills labor. That is one thing. The second thing, it would be sector. You have to move a little bit farther than just artificial intelligence, because it has limitations. There will be different works or type of jobs that would be more at risk. It's more easy to replace a journalist rather than or a welder, a person who is just performing a basic activity, that if you want to replace a teacher, for instance, because there is still some human aspects and characteristics that wouldn't be possible to replace. So it's understanding the labor market, and then from that thing, which one's about to be more at risk and in preparing. So it is job losing, yes, in one side, but in another side, it creates also opportunity. So let us stress more action, perhaps it would be my say.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll be very brief. Artificial intelligence doesn't, if it develops itself or somebody develops it, then the question is, how do you develop the social dimension and the labor understanding of artificial intelligence? I mean, there are a lot of norms and other things which need to be taken into account. And if artificial intelligence can deal with as much things as people are saying, so then somehow it's got to start dealing with this also.
All right. Thank you for those wise final words. I think, you know, as much as I'd like to invite in Raymond and Manuro and Jan Gustav to speak, we really have gone a bit over and we need to wrap up. So I'm going to make some final comments. And of course, the focus with that is thanking all of you so very much, our speakers, for being with us, for taking the time to do this. This particular event has proven to be extremely detailed. And I have to say, Jan Gustav and David might concur that you know, a great deal of detail, in some ways more so than we've had in the past. And that's why we let it run over a bit. I didn't want to cut any of you off to deny our attendees the knowledge and experience that you're able to bring to us. So with that, as you can see on your screen, we're wrapping up now. I'd like to thank all of you, in particular Jan Gustav and David, and David Horan, for organizing it and bringing our speakers in, our excellent speakers for their contributions, and especially all of our guests for joining us. As you can see on the screen, the next event is going to be on the 30th of March. We will send you the invitation for that very soon. And tomorrow you will receive a link from the Zoom platform to this video. That page will have the earlier videos and all of the presentations. So with that, I'd like to thank you all very much, wish you all the best, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you and goodbye.